said this is the 20th.
Oh, gotcha.
20th anniversary to the day.
Wow. Almost to the day. It was December 29th.
88?
December 29th, 1988, in Britain, Connecticut. Wow. It was at a restaurant called Roma Restaurant, which over the years we gathered there, it started out as an Italian restaurant, as the name implied, but what happened was the Italian owner sold to a couple of Polish people, Polish brothers maybe, or just partners, and so what they did with the menu was what it had been all Italian pizza and, you know, lasagna or whatever, they changed the menu over to, they kept the Italian stuff and added Polish stuff. So they had like, I don't remember what they're called now. Galumpkis, pierogies, sausages, all sorts of delicious things. Really good food, and it was basically a neighborhood restaurant. The town it's in, New Britain, Connecticut. Its only claim to fame is that it was the home of Stanley Tools. You know, the one you see advertised on TV. Yeah, that's where that it's like headquarters is or whatever. And so I grew up in that area, went to school in that town, had a university there. So I knew a lot of people, and the gatherings grew out of the fact that we would get together at each other's houses, and a lot of us wrote, friends, some play guitar, and we would just get together and share stuff. And then in 88, I read this book called The Inklings.
The what?
The Inklings.
Inklings.
Which was about a group of writers. It was about a famous group of writers, but they were of a kind that they were of a kind of group that existed during and after World War II in England at Oxford and Cambridge. You'd have these small groups of writers who would meet on a regular basis at a local pub or someone's house, and they would read each other works. And I was very inspired by that. The group that this book was about was called, they called themselves the Inklings, and they included J.R.R. Tolkien and C.S. Lewis and Charles Williams, yeah.
My mom's best friend in Holyoke owns a bookstore there, and they call it the Inklings Bookstore.
Yeah. Isn't that neat?
Yeah.
So I read this book and thought, well, I know enough people to be able to, do this kind of thing. And we'd gone to this restaurant for many years just because it was a good place to drink beer and the food was good. But they had a back room. This was the thing. It had a back dining room. Like, there was the main bar, and then you go up a couple of steps, and there was a back room with a bunch of tables, and it was kind of cozy. When nobody was there, it was kind of hidden from the melee of, you know, a bar on Saturday night or whatever. And so we started having gatherings there about once a month, and we did it for 13 years. Mm-hmm. And when I moved up to Boston, I'd come down once a month on the Greyhound bus, and someone would pick me up, and we'd go over there and have our gathering. It was a way of bringing all my friends together rather than trying to chase them down, since I was not living in the same place, and it was hard to get people to come and visit me all the time. So it was a way of bringing people together, keeping them in touch. So it was mostly people who wrote. Some of them were still in the cenacle. I mean, in that cenacle, there are people from this group that I still am dear with. Well, the cenacle came about as an offshoot of the Jellicle Guild. The Jellicle Guild started in 1988, and in 1995, some of my friends and I had made like zines and things, and back then a zine was not like it is now. It was like something you made on a typewriter, and you went to Kinko's and made a few copies, right, and you're all thrilled about it and everything. Yeah, so, I decided to, since I knew enough people and we gathered, you know, monthly, and I wanted to publish their stuff, I decided to buy a photocopier in 95 when I lived in Boston. It was a desktop photocopier. It cost $500. And wow. Now you can get them for, you can get them with your phones and things. But back then it was a big deal to have, for the first time in my own home, a means of reproduction. Because up to that point, I'd always depended on Kinko's or some outside source. But that was when I started slowly accumulating tools to publish myself and those who I, you know, wanted to publish, who would want to publish with me, and not have to depend on outside sources and having to please other people in order to who held the, you know, door and let you in or not. I decided that was not, it was unfair to the impulse of art, which I think is a part, it's part and parcel with the impulse to make or create. Because of our conscious minds, we seek to interact with the world, and some of that includes making the world. Somehow we've gone from just being aware of the world to wanting to express our awareness of the world, and that's where art comes in. And I think that I think that setting up an apparatus as we have here, or really Western society has for, in terms of publishing, they set up this high standard, these people, small coterie of people who decide what the current literary taste is, and it's reflected in magazines, and it's reflected in the books that are published by the higher end literary houses. And if you don't, and they've always existed, there's always been a sort of a central place that decided for the country what their taste was and who was in and who was writing the kind of thing and the way that, so that to me is antithetical to the art impulse, which you can see best in children. When you take a bunch of children, and as a teacher you know this, you put down crayons and coloring books and paints and stuff, and just, you know, they're off to town, and they're not thinking about aesthetics, and they're not thinking about external standards. They're just like, I want to paint that thing really good. Maybe I don't know how, maybe I do. Someone will teach me. But it's not so that mine will be better than someone else's. That's introduced into human life as a idea that is not, in my opinion, native to human life. It is a culturally driven thing. So by the time you end up as an adult, you have this impulse to make, which was sourced in, I think, human consciousness, and expressed probably as a child freely and less so since then. So you have an adult who has decided that their impulse to make needs to be validated by an outside judge. When a child comes to you with a piece of art, they say, look what I made, and they're all pleased. They're not looking to you to endorse it and to criticize it and to give your cultural stamp on it. It's like, no, we don't draw horsies that way this year. That's last year's style. We're more into expressionist horsies or whatever. But that was a joke. Anyway, so they get to the point of where they have the human sourced best in childhood impulse to make, and it's been laundered through this competitive cycle of years called education, where everything is judged, how you look, what you do. There's the smart kids, there's the dopers, everybody's labeled, everybody's something of one kind or another. And yet that impulse to make is still there. So they're writing their thing, or they're making their art, or they're doing their thing, but it's in their head that someone has to judge it and validate it. Someone has to take the painting and put it in a show, you know, a gallery. Someone has to take the piece of writing and put it in a magazine. Someone has to, you know, give you a record contract. At least it's in the old days. Now you can make your own, you know, thing. But someone external has to validate this natural impulse to make, to create, however it manifests. It could manifest in art. It could manifest in other ways. There are people who love gardening in a way that I would say is very aesthetic. They like the way things look. They like to arrange their plants, their flowers, whatever. They're taking their imagination and they're laying it out there visibly by working with the tools that at hand. And so with your friend, who I don't know, but just in terms of people who have not published, a lot of unpublished people are walking around, on the one hand loving to create and feeling they do it well, but on the other hand waiting for that validation. So my mission as far as being an editor is to find people who don't have, you know, lots of published works and whatever, or who have encountered things that have thrown up roadblocks sometimes for their creativity. Find those people and show them that there is an alternative to the competitive-driven way that art is treated, commodity-driven. This one sold for this amount. You know, this sold this many amount of records. Movies break box offices, you know, whatever. That there's an alternative to that. And that is essentially not thinking of art as a race, but thinking of it as a game we all play in one way or another. And that the more fun everybody has, the more fun the game is. So that's how I approach editing. I don't approach it as something where I tell someone that their work is good or not, or that I like it or not, so much as I try to figure out over the course of getting to know that person's work whether they are expressing themselves as on point as they can. And if I know their work well enough, I can do that. If I don't, then I don't have that basis to judge. You know, it's like hearing one song by a singer and deciding, oh, that's the guy that sings like Elton John. And it's like, well, if you got his album, you know he sings like, you know, 10 other styles too. And so I think that that's an approach to editing, but it's also my approach to art, which is that it's an open door. It's always there. It's always waiting. And while on the one hand, I don't hold against art being sold and valued, I don't believe it's ideal.
If you had heard many of my pieces, you would have gotten familiar with my friends Olga and Zhenya. Zhenya is the nickname for Eugene. Yevgeny mm-hmm. is her husband. And he was very, very much into, as many Russians are, very interesting spiritual beliefs. He was hungry to know all these things, and he had a very, very intelligent young man, but had not learned very much critical thinking. So when he heard about something new, he went off and explored it very intelligently and sometimes saw the flaws, but he got very enthusiastic. So he had gotten involved with this group of also very intelligent people, doctors and, you know, some of the real intelligentsia. This spiritual leader whose name was Monochance. I keep saying it in a French way, but the Russian way, it doesn't mean anything really in Russian. But when I asked Zhenya what it meant, he said mono meaning one and chance meaning chance. Ooh. Like you only have one chance. And it was like from a Greek or from Latin mono or Greek, whichever it is, and chance, which is chance in Russian, is kind of a funny word for luck or chance, or, you know, what you get. So anyway, this guy came out of the woodwork, and he's Russian, and he's like this, has this strange cosmology. I went to his dacha, and he had this cupola built on top, and it had five, like, gables, and one had a circle, and one had this thing that was like shaped like I think it's called a lens or whatever, like, you know, two, and then one was a triangle, one was a square, and there was a pentagon, and it was to allow entities to enter because some of them are one dimensional, some are two, three, four, and five, and they had to be that right shape or they'd get stuck coming into the house. Anyway, and he had very carefully built it and finished it. Anyway. This is called The Ritual of the Beverages, The Taste of Eternity. And I had, just because this is like pulled out of the middle of something, my friend Zhenya took me to the home of this very, very lovely woman, I think a couple woman, in Moscow, where this group was gathering to meet with Monochance to have a weekly teaching that he did. And so I got to go with Zhenya. Oh. And I had never met any of these people before, including Monochance, but Zhenya is taking it. Okay. When I look at my watch, I am surprised to find that it's already after 11. It seems the sun has only just set beyond the double curtains in the little room where we have been meeting for more than 5 hours. The summer sky stays light late into the night in Moscow. A second surprise greets us as we emerge into the living room. A long table has been assembled from assorted smaller tables with expanding leaves and covered with white cloths. It stretches the length of the room, entirely filling it. But rather than making the crowded room seem even smaller, it seems to push back the walls to create a great dining hall. Again, I think of the magical expanding Russian table. The more guests that arrive, the larger the table grows and the more food that appears. By some sleight of hand or magnanimity of spirit, Russian hospitality never seems to run out. The only thing on the table is a collection of bottles massed near the center. Wine, vodka, liqueurs, juices, the ubiquitous Pepsi, even a bottle of garish green kiwi soda. The women bustle to and from the kitchen with glasses and cups. The men pull the couch closer to the table, gather chairs. Come, Lyuda, our hostess, invites me. Find your place. It is one of Monachance's exercises to train us in the use of our higher powers. I am to sense the one right seat that belongs to me. The task reminds me of the long, frustrating night Carlos Castaneda spent seeking his right spot on Don Juan's porch until finally he dropped into exhausted sleep exactly where he should have. After everyone else finds their seat, mine will be the one that is left, I say lightly, and disappear into the bathroom.
Very clever.
My place turns out to be near the end, next to Lyuda, with Zhenya at the corner across from me, and Marina, the only other English speaker besides Zhenya in the group around the table, four chairs away from him on the other side. Monachance sits half a dozen seats down from me on the same side of the table, close to the center, holding court. Everyone laughs and chatters. Yet when Monachance speaks, they fall into easy silence. Not the silence of intimidation or forced respect, but simply the eager silence of those who don't want to miss anything. I can't imagine a more relaxed, congenial group. Their good spirits are contagious, and I'm glad I agreed to stay. I'm glad I'm here at this party. But I wish I'd been more assertive about claiming my seat. I wish I'd finagled a way to sit between Jenny and Marina so that they could translate for me. And I wish I were across from Monachance so that I could watch him as he talks. From my place on the same side of the long table, the only way I can see him is to lean forward and twist unnaturally. Never before have I been so aware of the importance of nonverbal communication. I can hear his words, resonant, but in a Russian I can hardly understand. With most of the meaning lost this way and no face-to-face reality testing, his voice is soothing, disembodied background music. When Monachance addresses his words to me, I am aware of it only because all the other faces turn toward me with friendly looks of expectation. I am on the spot. Everyone waits for my response to the precious words of the master. Zhenya, perched like an afterthought at the corner of the table, and Marina, four seats down from him, stumble together in a kind of verbal dance to interpret. Their earnest English translation seems to give great pleasure to the others at the table. There is much smiling, nodding, whispering, and obvious affection and goodwill toward me. With all this activity bombarding my senses between the moment Monachance's words are uttered and the time I finally understand what he says, the part I do understand, which is far from most of it, there is the eerie sensation that he speaks from the length of a long tunnel. The table with its white cloth and collection of bottles in the center does look unnaturally long, as if viewed through the wrong end of a telescope. I can watch his words travel down the tunnel to me, bouncing off the many friendly faces along the way. Each of them adds a bit of energy, a personal spin to the message. Like everything that is truly Russian, this is a collective project. I feel the energy of everyone in the room each time a communication reaches me. In the midst of the cheerful conversation, people begin to open bottles and then to pass them to Manichance. The person who brought the beverage must be the one to open it, Zhenya explains. That's part of the ritual. Part of the ritual is also another exercise in choosing. This time, our proper drinking vessel, from among the cluster of ceramic mugs, teacups, glasses, and lustrous Kokhlama cups the women have put on the table. It takes many minutes for each person in turn to consult the higher powers and make a choice, sometimes with Manichance's approval, but more often with a shake of the master's head and the command to try once more. I try my joke again. Mine is the one that will be left after everyone else chooses. But the others laugh and refuse to let me off so easily, although they're gracious enough to wait till there are only three glasses left before they sit back to watch me choose. Go on, try, Zhenya urges. Take your time. Let yours speak to you. I study the three glasses. One looks to be good crystal with a design of tulips etched around the base. One, heavier and plainer, has a small chip on its rim. The third has nothing in particular to distinguish it. Although I don't feel any guidance from the higher powers, I do feel the urge to take the glass with the chipped rim, perhaps to leave the nicer one for someone else. When I reach out to touch it, there is a disappointed release of breath around the table. No, says Manichance. Try to feel the energy. Your glass will call out to you. I look at the remaining pair of glasses. I have a 50-50 chance of getting it right this time. Then I realize, of course, that the lovely crystal one is intended for me. What else than to offer the best to the foreign guest? Confidently, I reach for it. Another group sigh, and then laughter. No, says Manichance. I laugh too, and sheepishly I take the last glass. The others tease and congratulate me. So what did you feel as you listened for the higher powers to reveal your glass to you? Manichance asks. The others listen intently as I explain my reactions, first to the chipped glass and then to the most elegant one, both of which turned out to be wrong. And the right one, what did you feel about it? Manichance smiles, but his gray eyes are serious as he waits for my answer. Well, nothing actually, I admit. It didn't make any impression on me at all. Just so, says Manichance. This one, and he motions toward the first glass I picked, communicated something negative to you. And it's interesting that you chose it first. This one, indicating the second one, the etched crystal, something positive. Again, wrong. The natural way to move through life is the balanced way. Neither negative nor positive. Neutrality. The absence of desire or aversion. This, the neutral glass, is your right glass. I concede that it makes sense and study the humble glass in my hands with something akin to respect. The golden mean, moderation in all things. Eschew all desire and fear. Seek detachment. The message is not a new one. At some signal I don't detect, we all pass our glasses down to Monachance, who selects a bottle of red wine and begins to pour. He divides it more or less equally among the 20 cups and glasses before him. Each contains slightly less than an inch of the deep ruby liquid. Then he takes a bottle of white wine. The label shows it to be Chinese, something I've never seen in Russia, and begins to pour a splash of this, too, into each of the glasses. Through my careful translators, I understand Monachance to say that this beverage I am sipping, this strange concoction that he has transformed into the soma of the ancient Vedas, has still more to offer me. Oh, you know, I think I've cut out a part there because I got the ellipses there. He ended up pouring something from all of the bottles that were there that included many different liqueurs and many different sodas and many different herbal things that people had brought. He mixed it all together, and everybody's glass ended up with this cocktail of everything that people had brought. Everybody had been invited to bring a beverage, and then there were all these different glasses. Everybody had to choose something to bring and then choose where they were going to sit and choose their glass, and then they got this mixture. So now, and then everybody has to drink it. And it was, I've forgotten because I haven't read this. Once transformed, he explains, one cocktail can become 12 different cosmic beverages. So go ahead and experiment with it. Let it be a number of different experiences. Compare them. You will see. They will taste entirely different from each other because they will be entirely different substances. My senses are slowed. When I don't respond right away, the smiling company around the table encourages me. Liuda disappears into the kitchen and returns with a clutch of fresh cups and lays them out on the white tablecloth. Hands reach out, select 3 cups, arrange them before me. Beaming, nodding faces glow in the warm light. Try it. Take these cups. Pour a third of your drink into each of them. Check out this wonderful claim. I gather my wits about me and willingly enter into the experience. 3 teacups in front of me. Smoothly, I divide the contents of my still full glass among them, then align them carefully in a row so that Monachance can see them. He leans forward, smiles gently down the table at me. Now you must decide what you want each of them to be, he says. My thoughts immediately jump to images of death. I want to understand Olga's death. But I can't say this out loud, not with Zhenya here, not in this party atmosphere. Silently, a question forms itself. I want to experience death. Olga's death, Gail's death, Michael's death, my own. The death we all face, and thus the purpose of life, the transcendent meaning of death, the reason for it all. How can I say this? I can't say it out loud. I can't risk casting a pall over this relaxed, happy group. I can't even put it into words for myself. It is a snaky feeling that eludes capture, though I feel it coiled and tense in the pit of my soul, waiting in the darkness. Well, there is, after all, no need to put it into words. I sense it clearly enough in the shadows of my mind. This simple, unverbalized awareness of death is the question I want to explore. I nod and smile at Monachance, at the glowing faces turned towards me. Okay, I've got it, I say. The silent attention intensifies. 19 other faces, open, loving, supportive, expectant. Wait. Do I have to say it out loud? I ask. And even as I say the words, I realize the lameness of this question. This is Russia, after all. the land where the overbearing shadow of fear, secrecy, protectiveness of one's public persona only throws into relief the magnitude of the treasured openness and interconnectedness, the collectivity of one's private experiences in the midst of friends. Of course I must share my question with these friends. Whatever is going on for me is the gift I have to offer them. They trust me. I have been admitted into this circle of trust. My hesitancy, the hesitancy of a foreigner, is easy for them to understand. But in the presence of their loving acceptance, there is no reason for me to hold back. They are waiting for me to confide in them. My Western reasons for keeping my thoughts to myself hold no sway here. I see this and I decide to let go. Even though I find myself caught in the fine web of speechlessness, I can at least try to say what's in my mind. I can grab whatever words rise to the surface. I look at the three cups in front of me, the chance to taste three different realities. Just ask and taste the answer. This is an opportunity I may never again encounter. Whether or not I believe is irrelevant. This game is fun, absorbing. And I'm happy to be here with these people. I look once more at the faces turned toward me. Read the sincerity in them. I take a deep breath and I begin. This is the taste of eternity, I say, as I point to the first cup. Specifically, the eternity before I was born. In this one, I want to taste what the cosmos, I deliberately use one of their key words, was like before I was born. And then I gesture toward the third cup. Here, in this cup, is the taste of eternity after my death, the eternity that will be from the end of my life until forever. I pause, less for effect than for concern over the hush that has fallen over the table. All are poised to hear my words. And this, the middle cup, I continue, is the taste of the reality we are in right now, the reality within the time frame of my life. This is the taste of eternity while I am alive, what my life means within the hold of eternity. Zhenya looks at me without moving. I turn towards Marina, who smooths the cloth in front of her and begins haltingly to translate. Her words in Russian echo in the background, but it is only my own thoughts that I hear in my head. There is a long silence, almost confusion, and I'm not sure if Marina's words in Russian mean anything to the attentive audience. She is intent, concentrating fully on what I have said and what she now translates. I listen as she finishes. So do the others. Then, like a wave of light sweeping over the table, their faces come to life. Manichance, too, is smiling, radiating loving energy, saying something in Russian. Everyone speaks now, nodding, laughing. Lyuda hugs me. A few hands reach across the table to touch me. Other hands, all down the length of the table, burst into applause. Yes, they're clapping, murmuring to each other. Zhenya smiles, cocks an eyebrow at me, and mouths, Molyadets. Congratulations. Well done. Manichance responds, and again Marina translates. "You have asked a very deep, very primary question," she says. "All of us here tonight recognize the high spiritual plane you are on. Manishan scolds us, some of us, because we have been studying with him for years and haven't reached the level of understanding you have reached in just this one night. I want to protest and make light of it. This is just an interesting game for me, and I'm playing with lofty words I don't really mean. But instead of protesting, I calmly acknowledge their respect. After all, it is a good question. The taste of eternity before, during, and after my life in the physical world. I'm proud of what I've wished for, and ashamed to feel this pride. But it is indeed the question I would ask if I really did believe I could learn the answer from Anishans, from this ritual of the beverages." Everyone watches attentively as Manishans again performs his magic, closing his eyes, moving his hands, intoning something I don't understand. I watch the three cups in front of me. The dark liquid reflects light, moves gently with the shaking of the table as someone bumps against it. Manishans' invocation is brief this time, compared to the earlier ceremony of introducing the beverages in the cocktail to each other. A chorus of voices urges me to taste the contents of the three cups. "It is ready," says Marina. "Manishans has transformed them, and you must now taste them. See how they are different and learn what they have to teach you." I lift the first cup, the one that I have designated to hold the taste of eternity as it was before my birth. I sip, let the beverage slide over my tongue, hold it a moment in my mouth before I swallow. It feels no different than it did before when I drank it as soma, a not unpleasant Swedish mixture with vague cola undertones, rather what you'd expect from a random melange of several wines, sherries, and cognacs in a base of Pepsi and kiwi fruit syrup. Next, I taste the beverage in the third cup, eternity as it will be after my death. The same procedure. A sip, a mulling in the mouth and in the mind, a swallow. My face must register my surprise, for my audience bursts into affectionate laughter. I take a second sip. Am I imagining that it does taste radically different than the drink in the first cup? The contrast is too striking to be a trick of my imagination. It's not so much the taste of the liquid that's different. It's the same sharp, fruity sweetness, but rather the feel of it on my tongue. Now I am aware of each of the ingredients in isolation, a subtle interweaving of separate flavors that together make up a very complex experience. The sensation in my mouth is almost visual. I feel the beverage like a beam of sunlight that's passed through a prism and emerged as a fan of colors. The different ingredients have become unmixed, as it were, and yet they still work together to make something that reveals a whole new dimension. This, the third brew, is an enormously intricate and subtle blend of flavors. It's very complicated and colorful, I say, very different from the first one. The faces around me nod and smile, and Manishans gestures for me to taste the remaining drink. I lift the middle cup, the one designated to contain the taste of eternity as it is during my lifetime. I hold it beneath my nose for a moment and swirl it and sniff. I take the liquid into my mouth and find that it feels different from the liquid in both the first and third cups. This time, I'm not surprised. It tastes effervescent, sparkly, tingling, almost alive. Of course, this is the taste of the consciousness of the cosmos while I'm passing through it. It's my own living energy in action, changing the nature of eternity from what it was before to what it will be after I'm gone. Very busy and energetic, I tell the delighted group around me. There's a lot of activity going on due to my presence in the cosmos. Carefully, I place the cup back on the table in its spot between the other two. I stop trying to follow the gist of the animated conversations that break out all along the table, and simply let the warmth of the Russian words wash over me. Then I ask, may I taste each of the drinks again? Marina assures me I may, even as she translates my question from Anishan's. He smiles and nods, gesturing towards the three cups. I sip from them in turn, reminding myself that they were all poured from the same glass, that I poured them myself. There's no way the three cups contain anything but the same identical beverage. I will, my usual cautious skepticism, to take a stance on this. Perhaps I've just been caught up in a sort of hypnosis created by the group around me. My uncharacteristic suggestibility, the late hour, the lack of food with the drink. There can't really be any difference in the three beverages. But just as before, I again experience them as three unique tastes, or rather sensations. The simple, the complex, and between them, the energetic. After my second round of sips, Monachance asked me to interpret the lesson the cosmos has chosen to teach me about eternity. My response rolls easily out. My life is not insignificant. Because of my life, the nature of eternity is changing for the better. I am putting my energy into the cosmos, and this contributes to the building of consciousness. My life is a vital contribution to the consciousness of the cosmos. It isn't exactly what I intended to say, but it feels right. Monachan smiles and shrugs his shoulders, as if to say, of course, what else could it be? Then he explains, through Marina's careful translation, that my question about eternity was a good one, even Lichnuya, an excellent one. And because he wanted me to have the experience of tasting for myself, the liquid in the three cups actually did change into three different beverages, he therefore transformed it into the triad of different sensations that I described. But, he continues, there's one more thing to realize. He picks up his own glass, almost empty, and swirls the liquid in it as he talks. There is but one eternity. Before our birth, after our death, all this is outside of time, timeless, unchanging. So your question was a paradox. You sought to know the differences within unity. Now taste the beverage in the three cups again. I do as he tells me. The first cup, the third one, and finally the one in the center. All three of the liquids taste the same, and taste just like the mixture did when I took the first swallow from my larger glass. The intricate spectrum of flavors, the lively sparkle of effervescence, these are gone. I taste the smooth sweetness of the cocktail. The Pepsi dominates slightly as it did before. I look up and meet Monachance's eyes. Eternity beyond this narrow world is unchanging, he says. All of it is always there, and always right here for us to know. He lifts his glass as if for a toast, and drains the last of his beverage in one swallow. I do the same with each of my three cups in turn. The sweet liquid goes down easily.
Wow. I mean, but so what?
Well, she recently had a friend's husband who committed suicide, and she's been very sort of torn up about that. So she said she wasn't very much in the mood for writing poetry, but she was posting these little snippets online, like replies to people's poetry on different poetry boards. And so Raymond put together a sort of a notes on how to go on from her replies that were really beautiful poetry, even though she was saying she's really just not able to write poetry right now. But she still is. So this is the first one. One breath, one small step, a little dusting, a polish, a broom, a sudden cookie sheet, Magimix to get me through this minute, a chocolate bar to compose into chips. One stir, one mix, one short flick of a switch. I cry. I sing to the whir of the batter. I am. I do. This I cannot continue. I am a giver of joy. I pledge this joy to you. Every happy face will be yours in cookie mode. You will live in every crunch of every delicious mouthful, of every mouth that crunches. This I can do. This I can do. My love I give to you, I will always give. The way out is the way in. Turn, turn, turn. An upside-down solution to an unsolvable question. Inside out, mother foe. Yeah, I said it. Yeah, yeah, mother fa. No, I don't mean maybe. It's this way and out the back door. No, Lord. No, sweet Lord. No mantra chanting Lord. No. They went that away, the gods and goddesses of yesterday. Put on some bling, some kitsch, some instantaneous dish, some miso in a macrobiotic point of view, and off they went. How do I know? I just go. So.
I just remembered something interesting. I promised her that I would read one of her poems.
Oh, okay.
So, I'll read the next one. What do you do? When tragedy strikes, mind whirls. Constant humming, waves askew. Sound too much treble. Overtones jar. I'm reeling for a friend, real sad. She's grieving, and I say how to go on. I know snow falls, and I'm wishing I could feel it. Snow falls, life goes on, simple cycles go on, pushing for an ohm moment to go on.
An ohm moment.
Torch and cave wall, I see the writing left by others. Hold focus, you can survive this. It all will pass, 1 minute at a time. We all did it, you can do it. Listen to us sing. We did it, you can too. My battery's on full, battery may be smaller. My intentions are on high, expectations may be amorphic. Body's ticking forward, tipping over. All's accounted for. What's a tooth or a hair pigment? It's all good. It's all I got going on. That's the last one. A human being is born, as we know, after a 9-month gestation period. Physical energy is transferred from the mother to the fetus. When birth takes place, the soul is tabula rasa and will be influenced by events to come. However, there is a point in one's life where energy is stored by acting in right conduct, participating in the truth, pursuing art, and all of the above. The individual decides what is intrinsically sound and what is not. The time of this decision varies from individual to individual, and in some cases, perhaps in most, does not happen at all. Mahatma Gandhi started when he was about 30 years old. I started at about 54. The point is that a transformation from the physical to the compilation of spiritual being takes place. Every day that I live is now devoted to my family and spiritual maintenance. It is at this juncture that I part with traditional physicists. Einstein's relativity theory, and more recently Stephen Hawking's attempt to unify quantum mechanics and gravity, are only concerned with the physical universe and cannot justify traveling faster than light because the amount of energy required to do so is unobtainable in this universe. However, when one adds the spiritual energy accumulated during an individual's lifetime, we exceed the speed of light at the moment of physical death, and the collective energy melds into a revelation of cosmic reality. The mass reality found in the physical universe is ignored and cast aside totally. An important point: by collective energy, I mean not only from an individual's accumulation, but also from all individuals' accumulation and contribution that is ongoing. We all become stars when we die, not only on an individual basis. The important distinction to be made is that the individual and the collective are polar opposites when comparing the physical and spiritual, metaphysical and beyond, levels of existence. There can be no causality on a spiritual plane. Truth is. Reality is. Duality can be studied by juxtaposing the physical and spiritual planes, but certainly not within the latter. My argument here encapsulates the tragedy that this country and the world has recently been through, especially during the last 8 years. The chance for humanity to use its spiritual forces for its own betterment has been utterly wasted. There is very little, if anything, positive that can be noted from the present administration's last 8 years in office. History will be the ultimate mirror for mankind to reflect on how terrible these people really were. has all been said and will be repeated. This country learned nothing from Vietnam and supported a war initially that eventually was proven and even admitted by George W. Bush to have been started by this country. Although the circumstances were suspect from the beginning at best, and eventually shown to have been falsified deliberately, to start a war is an unimaginable horror. It is so unthinkable that our government would permit this that I have now made a conscious decision to withdraw from the manifestation of the wrong conduct of others, including those of our government. I demand the truth. I always have, but now I will act on it. I will contribute all my energy while I am alive on the physical plane and convert it to the spiritual collective when I die. There are many of us on this planet, and I think intuitively many others throughout the galaxies. Every so often, more so now than originally theorized, the suns we become explode and the dust is released, traveling in part back to this planet in the form of the light from what is classified as a supernova. Technology allows us to look back in time and see the light from long ago. When enough of the stardust eventually reaches our Earth, the evolution will occur. Each one of us will pass on, and from that point forward, not only will we all become stars when we die, but the stars will become us. As John Lennon said, imagine. Peace and love to all, Jim Burke III. I read my favorite W.S. Merwin.
Oh, good.
Rainlight. All day the stars watch from long ago. My mother said, I am going now. When you are alone, you will be all right. Whether or not you know, you will know. Look at the old house in the dawn rain. All the flowers are forms of water. The sun reminds them through a white cloud, touches the patchwork spread on the hill, the washed colors of the afterlife that lived there long before you were born. See how they wake without a question, even though the whole world is burning.
So about 6 months ago, I wrote a letter to him when he was still running for president, and he was still locked head in head with Hillary. And
you told us about that. I'm glad we get to see it now.
Yeah. And it was a tough letter. It was you're raising a lot of hopes here, and you're getting a lot of people excited, and that's really good. But you know, then once we're going to get you elected, and we're going to make sure you follow through, because you know, we've had a lot of bad years, and you know, you're saying you're going to help shepherd us out of it, so okay, but you know, just make sure when we get you in that office that is always your priority. And as time went on and I observed Obama on the campaign trail, I listened to his speeches. I listened to him when a couple of times really resonated. One was the Yes We Can speech after he won in Iowa. That was like this speech when a lot of people started noticing him, that Yes We Can speech. Then when the Reverend Wright scandal, quote unquote scandal, came out, and he gave that magnificent speech about race in America, that like 2 days later, and he wrote it himself. It was just incredible. It was not only what he said, but it was the fact that in the middle of a media barrage, a kind of blood fest swinging, evil, horrible corporate media kind of thing, he sat down and said, okay, they're coming at me because of my race, and I knew this was coming, and now here it is, and now it's time for me to say something, and I'm not just gonna come out with some little tiddly, you know, minor little statement just to keep them at bay. I'm going to tell them all I think about race as a man, as a black man, as an American, as a student of history and politics, someone who understands the history of American governance and going back to its beginnings, its good points and its bad. And he gave the most magnificent speech that could possibly be imagined. And I just kept listening to him, and he kept seeming to be who he claimed he was. And we got him elected. We got him elected thoroughly. We got him elected with absolutely no way anybody could deny it. And I decided that it was now time for me to write him a second letter as president-elect. Sort of a follow-up to the first letter, and maybe I'll write him more letters when he becomes president, but I wanted to write him a second letter. And so it was last Saturday night that Cassie and I was doing a lot of writing, and Cassie was doing a lot of stuff, and we were getting ready for this meeting, and part of it was I needed to write this letter finally. I'd built up my thoughts, and it was time. So So this letter is dated December 13th, 2008 from Coffee Time Coffee House. Do you know that on 21st? We go there a lot. We go there a lot. It's a very strange place. Yeah, I wrote this last Saturday. Dear President-elect Obama, I am writing to congratulate you on being elected President of the United States. It was thrilling to be part of your campaign, to witness the hopes your campaign raised translated into a thorough victory on November 4th, a clearly enunciated statement by millions repudiating the policies and attitudes ruling the world this past 8 years. George W. Bush's time is over. He will leave office this coming January a disgraced, humiliated man, a spectacular failure, a would-be king now shown a humbled fool. Between the hopes your campaign spoke toward again and again and the deep abiding loathing for Bush, your victory became more and more likely and then happened. Wow, it really happened. Since then, you have been readying to take office, selecting your cabinet and others who will join you in Washington, D.C. I am particularly pleased by your choice of Hillary Clinton for Secretary of State. I think she will be terrific in the role of mending international relations, repairing the tattered American image. She is a brilliant woman, and I'm sure will work tirelessly for peace and reconciliation. I also admire your commitment to a bipartisan cabinet. Some frankly do not. Many are progressives and already halfway off your bandwagon. Don't want to believe you will keep promises. Don't want to get fooled again. Some talk as though you're already in office breaking promises left and right. Sir, I don't bear any such doubts. I am certain you are intending to keep promises and do good by all. I believe in your intelligence, your heart, and most of all, your empathy toward others. I believe when you say you wish to be the leader of one nation and will work with any who will work with you and will listen to all who speak. I believe there will be both victories and defeats, better and worse days. Bush is soon gone, but his kind, the iniquitous of this world who feed on the suffering of others, their vulnerabilities, sometimes their ignorance, goes on and on. The human soul may pitch towards stars, open-handed to every living being, a mortal thing ringed with countless coronas of music, even as it may also ignore all sufferings or sensations not its own, take from others while wearing a bland, righteous mask, judge a skin color or a genital kind or a language or a philosophical or a political opinion enough to damn another, burn down his house, annihilate his loved ones, leave him gutted and dying on an empty street. Thus it can be reasonably said that you will continue along other steps as much as you begin anew. There will be doubters and those who resist your ideas about one American family, much less one human family or one planetary family. People will often fall back on two questions. What's in it for me and mine? Why do I have to give up for others and why? Each of us, to some reasonable or unreasonable degree, will be watching how you govern from this perspective. As hard as getting elected was, and as improbable as that victory, what's to come will utterly overshadow it. The American economy, and by extension the global economy, has been reduced to a shambles. Two unfinished wars continue in Iraq and Afghanistan. Regional wars threaten in half a dozen parts of the world. The environment's condition is deteriorating, even as powerful interests will try to continue American addiction to foreign oil, not to mention its lack of affordable health care for millions. The litany of woes goes on and on. There is always, frankly, a litany of woes. Mortal things suffer. We love and break up. We are lonely. We are sick. We die. Most of us labor all our lives just to survive, to retire for a few elderly years of sitting in the sunshine, feeling worn out and useless. The elite among us, not among the millions of wage slaves, fare better along the way, but still end up in a box or an urn, just a prettier one. What I come back to, what I find the movable space in all this, what I call the imaginal space of possibilities, is what resides, figuratively at least, in the human heart. What got you elected was not policy so much as a persistent tapping at these secret, precious, vulnerable places. A dark-skinned man has never led this race-wounded nation. A still young man who grew up poor, fatherless, lived some years overseas, worked very hard and gained his entrance into the finest universities in the land. Well-spoken does not describe your speeches. They cry, they ring, they summon, they urge to heal, to unite. After a dark, bloody, shameful decade infested with lies, with brutality, with ever-increasing disappointments and diminishing prospects, you stood up and said, "Yes, we can." You talked in words both plain and golden of hope, of change. You shifted the cultural dialogue from tomorrow's next calamity to tomorrow's new possibility. Your opponents mocked you and called your words pretty, empty, delusional. Each one misread what people wanted. Each promised to be a knight against encroaching darkness, a parent checking under the bed and in the closet for monsters. You didn't. You simply said, get up, check the closets with me, now under the bed. The worst monsters live in your hearts. Now remember. Now you know. I believe, Mr. President-elect Barack, that you will do well, that you are suited for this great, hard task. You will push this nation and the world as a whole towards smarter, kinder, and eventually more prosperous days. You will lead and inspire. Others will listen, will find a model to emulate in one way or many. As always, what good that happens will not annihilate suffering or selfishness or plain stupidity. Neither fullest moon's beauty nor bloodthirstiest war lasts perpetually. Or perhaps more accurately, life shifts between them, strangely allows and accommodates both. There will always be beauty. There will always be war. You know what you have to do, your many tasks, the many expectations, countless possibilities and pitfalls, mysteries beyond view, unknowable turns of fortune. Tonight, some 7 weeks from when you take your oath of office, I am thinking of you with love, with respect, with a deep sense of fraternity with you, and with every possible good wish that you will succeed more often than fail, move the world into clearer air, deeper awareness of our better impulses and of each other. Tonight, I am with you in heart and spirit. I am hopeful. Nothing is impossible. We can do this. Yes, we can. Peace and love, Raymond Soulard. I'm going to read the most recent group of poems I've written. These are written over the course of the past 2 weekends. Excuse me, I set myself to writing a certain number of poems for publication, and so I was writing a lot of poems on the weekend. Fortunately, Cassie and I know places where you can go and sit a really long time, and she brings books that she reads. Like, she reads like a novel an hour, and have to bring six of them. And yeah, so we end up talking to her a lot. It's a funny place. The raver kids come in, they're sitting talking to the homeless people. You know, just really crossroads of people. It's kind of nice that way. I mean, there aren't too many places where you get a heterogeneous population. Okay, so these are the most recent poems I've been writing, and they were written over the course of the past couple weeks. First one's empathy. Love's long blind reach into the dark. I become one with your grief, with your caterwaul, your moment's heated fancy. I call this empathy and remember a story years back. We were both close to homeless, him in a mobile home, me in a rooming house. It was near Christmas. We sat together on a bench. We talked about love, about what falls away with clothes and what doesn't. The last time I saw him was a bookstore, a cold night, been a brilliant day, and now long disappeared. Yet, I told him my fleeing beloved had written, had not forgotten. Touched his hands, we smiled, agreed all things are possible. I remember now by your absence, by the vagueness of who you were. I remember because most flakes away false. That beloved no truer than many others. But that our friend, smile between us, touched hands. I am still reaching too, for better and worse. This is called Betrothed.
Called what?
Betrothed. Cassie and I were talking about the word betrothed one day. And it means engaged. We were trying to figure out if we were each other's betrothed. And I said we were always betrothed. It's a state of internal engagement. So anyway, this poem is called Betrothed. Had you known me as the sloppy wildcat of my youth, I could have explained less and more. My love for you then had been more like caterwauling blades than a dreaming, ceaseless, strange engine. I look around more often now than up. You remind me to look up. City's glare, heart's old noises, those griefs, keep looking up. This one's called High on Labyrinth. High on Labyrinth.
High on Labyrinth.
Yeah. How narrow the faith to forecast despair for all, call the world old, doomed, explain suffering by one dead prophet's return, or the collapse of all history to one single ignited moment. Plant eaters, icon kneelers, hustlers of end-time terrors, feel the doubt glare through you from chandeliered skies above. Feel your thick tomes and deviled costumery break by centuries. Break by the long cry each new voice echoes on. Break by the hope each heart bears, no matter the darkness setting in.
Page
21. This is called Countermythos. Dust, a violent hour, endurance. This is why you suffer. Failure to feel your suffering in my heart. Breach the lies of kings and preachers. The market's easy delight in slinging new ass. Strange need to call for love, for calm, as though a soul needs to be convinced to breathe, to sup. That man in tatters before you, swaying for a coin. That woman crouched and weeping. Armies praying tonight for a god's nod on the morrow. Dust, a violent hour, endurance. The many calls to despair, to gird better one's treasures. This is why you suffer. Ignore the world's many fecund puzzles, the green oncoming despite. Despair and fall. Now down, nearly gone, wreck that breathing earth, beneath grass or concrete. Cry up a little song of hope in its rhythms, by your own beats. And this one's called Tuning the Static. When passing water this morning, I thought of you passing yours. Torrents of blood, hidden waterfalls, the very key to the world found in summing all and dividing by one. This is deep space. One late night I will be gone. It will be hours or years later. My books have crumbled, my deeds blurred. What I was tonight, writing as though never to cease, reaching my heart for music to salve and share, become bones and dust, and the final opening of this path from a few mad crackling years to what it feels like to dream forever. Persist. What it feels like to dream forever, undo hook of want in the blood, year's ache of inner tides, push, pull, breach further, a sensation not yet flown in song, other hustles among coin and ass, for the rhythms that bed bedding bodies. No, become, the hand which tosses the seeds, what not taught or told, the map before the pathways laid. Map before. Would knowing help, watching that day again, walk itself through? Remember, heart's unspent music bound for colliding with that hour. The breath before, the decision to go, laughter. You came as one, left as another. Hunger so long held, long shaped, a new mold, now perhaps a new stuff entirely. Nearing, yes, you are nearing, the word, the glance, colors and breath mass into a name, a jacket, a vehicle, how God and dreams look to another. You are young, the night's immortal, even the talk of trifles excite you. Give back this hour. And this is Imaginal Space 4. It would be the same for any god. Nothing learned in the hundreds kneeling or mouthing the sacred songs. Nothing found in face smiling to face on the high holiday. The cheerful choirs, the best washed virgins smoothly singing of sin and penance, and the fine thoughts of each in his or her creased white uniform. Blessed be, blessed be, blessed always. Fumbled down into the mystery, the careening hungry hour, flesh so gnawing for flesh, and one god a thousand, thousand miles away. And another near, so near, that hands knowing touch on skin, the laugh and cry and shedding clothes. Feel that God is the breathing twins, as sinews bind hearts. The few words, love, hard, touch, how the God would learn. What rises with next light, stained and crumpled uniforms, blessed be, blessed be, blessed always. Was it sin or new love or a darling good fuck? The God would listen to the words as limbs untangle, a breast to its harness, a cock into its sheaf. Uncertain words, because of that moment, those sacred songs, the strange way each and all bind and undo so easily. Imaginal Space 5. Nothing unbinds again. Space conjured is space real, no matter the bursts of darkness, the diminishing years, how touch hungers and sates and mercifully forgets. I know nothing and keep learning to sing. Nothing unbinds again, the lesson of drowned woods and old hearts. And this was the grand finale, with a coda. Blood on canvas. Bells ring, little, nothing. Ring again, and a drum, and another. Something beats, something breathes. There is movement, if not yet dancing. I ask the universe, why suffering? Why music? Bells ring, and the drums, and someone speaks a word. Bells ring, little, nothing. World bides its wicked, calls them preachers, crowns them kings. Rings again, and perhaps an organ, a sooth where it hurts, where the fist, the slur, the silence. I ask the universe, why want when so many lonely beds? Why hunger when the world bulges with stores? I ask, and someone speaks a word. Bells ring, someone speaks a word, and begins to lie. Explain and lie. Exhort to principle and promise and lie. Cry, we are one. Then parts the temple and its song. Bells ring, someone speaks a word, perhaps to sing, and now the lies are crooned through music. Suffer, these strange songs say, in all glory suffer. I ask the universe, why suffering, and why its glorious songs? Someone speaks a word, as though to explain, and another lie. Bells ring, little, less. Kindness most binds, but many would not be so bound. Bells ring, all listen, clear air ripples, sunshine plays out the minutes. Someone speaks a word, the moment again divides. And finally, I ask the universe, why suffering? Why music? And behold this world, my answer.
Flupots. It's the last week of school before Christmas vacation. 8-year-old Adam and I are both at home, housebound in our Moscow apartment. Adam is sick, and I'm taking care of him. It's a bad chest cold, maybe even the flu. He hacks and coughs and lies groggy in bed, and there's not much I can do for him except offer him juice and soup, Tylenol and Robitussin, and smooth his hair and his pillow. Mostly he sleeps, and I use the unexpected free time to catch up on my correspondence. Both of us are secretly happy to have the extra vacation. Over the 3 days he's been sick, I've talked to at least a dozen Russian friends on the phone. They're all alarmed, even though I do my best to reassure them. Nothing out of the ordinary, I say, just one of those things. Time will take care of it. But Russians don't take illness so lightly. There are very few over-the-counter remedies here, and probably just as few prescription ones, given the shocking state of Soviet medicine. So I shouldn't be surprised my concerned friends offer their help. Each of them has a suggestion for treatment or cure. Hot water and lemon, they tell me. Or vinegar and honey. Tepid tea. Or tea compresses to wrap tightly against Adam's chest. A whole catalog of herbs I'm unfamiliar with to brew up for internal consumption or external application. A wool scarf to wind around his throat. Cold cloths to wrap around his feet. This to drive the illness up and out of his body. And other folksy remedies passed among families and neighbors. I thank them and explain that I have plenty of things I've brought from America to deal with cough, congestion, fever, aches, and pains. I explain that it's viral and not bacterial, and that I trust in time and the body's ability to heal itself. They are clearly disturbed by my nonchalance. Some are convinced by my superior American knowledge. Others are just too polite to argue with me. And Ina, dear, strong-willed Ina, is determined to give Adam the care that he needs. She arrives at my door early on her way to work, pink-cheeked and twinkling under the layers of muffler and shawl that envelop her face and shoulders. I figure it costs her about 2 extra hours of commute time to come by here. Maybe 2.5 with the walk up the hill from the metro station in the snow and the slush. 2.5 hours. And that's not counting the time she spends fussing over Adam. She has brought with her a sort of a kit, still swaddled in slick paper from the Optech, the quaint Soviet version of a pharmacy. Briskly, she takes charge, unwrapping the various components of her compact little kit and laying them out on the dresser by Adam's bed. First to emerge is a shank of cotton, then a sort of a wand that looks like the tool I used for cleaning my flute back when I was a student, then a box of matches, and finally a dozen or more small globes of heavy clear glass. These globes, little pots, really, are about the size of eggs, hollow, and open at one end. And they roll and clink together as Ina lays them out on the paper that they came wrapped in. "You have some vodka, yes?" she asks me. "No," I say with considerable relief. "Vodka? There's no way I'm going to permit anyone to give vodka to my child. Not even if he has the flu, and not even in Russia, and not even if it's Ina." "Something that burns, then," she insists. "We must make this light up and burn." She twists a tuft of cotton onto the end of the wand and waves it at me. "Ah, the vodka isn't for drinking, only for setting the cotton aflame. Cognac? Lamp oil? Rubbing alcohol?" I run through the possibilities. Adam's chemistry set. It has an alcohol lamp. Quickly, I rummage and find the box and pull out a small bottle and open it for Ina. She sniffs and dips and lights a match, and smiles as the end of her wand bursts into blue flame. "Very good," she says with satisfaction and snuffs out the flame. She turns to Adam, a miserable lump in the bed, and whips back the covers. "Take off your shirt," she commands. I'm even more alarmed now than I was at the thought of Ina dripping vodka down Adam's raw little throat. What will she do? Drive out the flu demons with fire? But her voice is reassuring, even as it insists, and Adam obediently slips out of his t-shirt. Then he collapses flat on his stomach again. "So what exactly are you going to do?" I ask. She gives me a smile and waves toward the little round pots with the hand that isn't holding the recently extinguished torch. "I shall heat the air inside and put these on his back," she says. "They will make a bezvozdushnoye prostranstvo, a space without air, what we call in Russian a vacuum. Do you have such a word in English?" "Yes, a vacuum," I reply. "And what will this vacuum do on Adam's back?" Ina has already begun. She soaks the cotton with alcohol and lights it again. Deftly, she takes one of the glass pots, holds the open end briefly above the flame, and then plops it decisively onto Adam's back. Ouch. He starts and then quickly relaxes. Plop, plop. Two more heated pots are in place next to the first one before Ina answers my question. They adhere like suction cups and perch jauntily there between his shoulder blades, tilting slightly. "The vacuum draws the harmful elements up from the lungs to the surface of the skin," she explains, "and from the skin they can pass out of his body." "How do you feel?" I anxiously ask Adam. "Fine," he murmurs, almost asleep. Ina continues heating the interior of the pots and placing them firmly one after another in neat rows. Within moments, the area from his shoulders almost to his waist is dotted with the perky little globes. "Now we wait," says Ina, screwing the cap back on the alcohol bottle and tossing the cotton wad into the wastebasket. I wonder what we are waiting for. As the harmful elements seep up through Adam's skin, will something happen in the pots? Wisps of blue smoke, say, or beads of oily liquid condensing on the glass? Mm-hmm. Just what are we dealing with here? An exorcism? Silently, absurdly, I try to recite the names of the four medieval bodily humors. Blood, phlegm, bile, and the fourth one eludes me. Then, just as absurdly, I recall that George Washington was bled to death by the medical experts of his time. Prudently, I refrain from sharing this information with Ina. Long minutes pass in silence. Ina, eminently practical, checks her handiwork. Her fingers lightly touch the surface of the glass pots. And then she pulls one from Adam's back with a soft pop. It leaves a dull red circle on his skin, and I draw in my breath sharply. "Not quite yet," says Ina. "They're still warm." "Are they burning him?" "Oh, not at all," she replies. "Adam, how does it feel?" "Fine," comes his muffled voice from deep in the pillow. "It is actually quite a soothing feeling," she tells me, "like a massage. The blood moves faster, the skin warms, everything relaxes. You will see. He will feel much better after this and will recover more quickly." Again, Ina checks the temperature of the pots. Now she judges that it's time to remove them. Unceremoniously, she plucks them two at a time from Adam's back, as if she were pulling plums from a tree. A very red, raised circle glows from each spot that held a pot. The tender skin of my only child is aflame with bright red polka dots that, if not actually blisters, at least seem to protest the unusual treatment they've recently endured. Ina reads the alarm on my face and bursts out laughing. "This is really all right," she assures me, takes my hand and guides it to Adam's back. Gently I stroke the warm raised pattern on his skin. He sighs deeply. "How does your back feel?" I ask him. "I told you, fine," he says. "I want to go to sleep." Adam sleeps. Ina lays out all the equipment again next to his bed, instructing me to repeat the process when Adam wakes up, and then every couple of hours throughout the day. "It will make him feel better quickly," she says. Then with a hug, she's gone, off to begin her normal work day a couple of hours late. Her employer, she's assured me of this, will understand. I consider the paraphernalia arranged neatly on the dresser. Glass pots, wand, cotton, alcohol, matches. What kind of witchcraft is this? Drawing the harmful elements, the evil humors, out of Adam's lungs into these ludicrous glass suction cups to dissipate benignly in the stuffy air of our overheated Russian apartment. No harm has been done. I am amused, but not displeased, to have been given this glimpse into the convoluted Russian thinking about health and well-being. Folklore and tradition. What else to fall back on in the absence of modern medical practice? So, will I repeat the process on my decidedly 20th century American son, as Ina has instructed? I doubt it. It would lack integrity, lack the necessary seriousness that's the heart of whatever healing benefits the glass pot treatment holds. And so, as Adam slumbers, I gather up the contents of Ina's medical kit, carefully folding the flu pots once more in their original wrapping and tucking the package into the back of the linen closet, just as I've often tucked away my other souvenirs of this benevolent clash of cultures, modern American and emerging third world Soviet. Later, I will unwrap the flu pots and decide what to do with them, but for now, I'm grateful for such devoted friendship as Ina's and for the opportunity to be here this winter in Moscow to experience this time of transformation. Adam wakes in the early afternoon. I dose him with more Tylenol and cough syrup and bring him some juice and read to him for a while from Kipling, the stories that I at least never tire of. The cat curls in bed next to him, purring. Adam, still weak but quite cheerful, wants to get up for supper. Cultural imperialism. That's what Algernon would call my attitude of superiority toward Ina's flu pots. I denounce such cultural imperialism in other foreigners, but I can't, without hypocrisy, shed it myself. Nor do I want to in matters of health and safety, or even when it comes to simple comforts. Nevertheless, it saddens me to feel my cultural imperialism as a barrier between me and the wholehearted generosity of my Russian friends. Caller, that's it, the name of the fourth humor, the one I couldn't remember earlier. Caller was held responsible for melancholy and other ailments of mood. By bedtime, Adam's fever is gone and he is bouncing with energy. I, on the other hand, feel sluggish, irritable. He wants to stay up to watch a videotape of American TV shows that friends in the States have sent us. I want to shut everything down and crawl under my blankets to sleep. As I finally ease him into bed with the promise of all the TV he wants in the morning, I wonder if I'm coming down with the flu. Or have I absorbed the humors that Ina drew from Adam's lungs and released into our airtight Russian apartment?
Marijuana as ancient and modern healer. Page 1.
Yeah.
A recent article at Slate.com discusses what I have long suspected regarding the antibacterial property of cannabis. My own theory is sourced in the Bible of all places. Linguists have shown that the word cannabis is of Semitic origin and was unknown in Greek language. So in the translation from Aramaic Hebrew to Greek, scribes incorrectly chose the word calamus instead of cannabis. In the Old Testament, God gave the command to manufacture the holy anointing oil. God was very specific in those days. He said that myrrh, cinnamon, cassia, and the sweet, fragrant flowers of calamus were to be distilled, as a perfumer would do, into olive oil. The formula was very specific and is about 4 pounds of calamus flowers distilled with cinnamon and myrrh. Many species of this now extinct tree contain high levels of alkaloids, some of which are psychedelic like DMT, into 2 quarts of oil. An extremely potent concoction. God also imposed rules and regulations regarding the use and limits of this oil, as one would a powerful drug. One such rule is that it must be controlled by the priests and cannot be used outside of temple or given to just anyone. This oil is used to anoint Christian priests and heal the sick of the Jewish elite. Jesus Christ means the anointed one. One of his breaks with Jewish law occurred when he used the oil to heal the impoverished sick of leprosy and blindness and skin infections by pouring large amounts of this oil over them, and then after a while plunging them into the river to wash off the remaining oil in a baptism. This must have been a very intense experience, not only for the patient, but for anyone witnessing this event. Seeing God and having your disease cured in a single act of one man with a bottle of oil would be seen as a miracle even today. I think that the holy anointing oil was a powerful drug of antibacterial, antiviral, and psyche-altering properties. In this light, the Jesus story makes much more sense. Who could doubt he was the Son of God? Who would not follow him after witnessing these healing miracles and hearing about the cosmic consciousness attained by those so healed? It is overwhelming to contemplate what the world would be like had these early Greek scribes used the correct word, how one little mistake in translation can totally alter the course of the world forever. Cannabis was often used by most ancient Semitic tribes. There are large stone pots that are coated with burned cannabis resin and seeds. Archaeological finds indicate that piles of cannabis flowers were burned in a tent or hut like a smoke lodge. Cannabis flowers are still offered as a sacrament in this way by Ethiopian Coptic Christians, the earliest Christian sect, I believe, as well as possibly being descendants of one of the lost tribes of Israel. To understand the letter C, we must also talk about the letter G, which shares, if not its sound, at least its shape, history, and meaning. The Romans used only the hard sounds of these letters, the ones in gobble and copper, ga and ka. The soft sounds in gem and center are newer and less typical, and we'll ignore them for now. As we go along, keep in mind that the hard C can also be spelled K or Q, as in cub, kitten, quail, and that S can precede any one of these letters, as in scowl, skill, squish. These minor disguises aside, the guttural ka and ga are easy and important sounds in human language, and in not-so-human ones, too, for crows caw and dogs say gur. They're easy sounds because they come right from the throat. Latin gutter, whence their old name gutturals. Modern linguists prefer the term velar, but the older name really clues us in better because a great many guttural sounds frankly concern the gullet or its opening, the mouth. A second great family of velar words, just as big and nearly as important, concerns skin and other surfaces. Of the two sounds, G is slightly more mouthy and C more surfacing, but in broader terms, they are quite interchangeable, and both letters share many semantic subsets that we will need 2 essays to handle them all. This first essay is devoted to mouth sounds.